Nietzsche was certainly a man of strong opinions, especially about people. As he read and heard about various authors and predecessors, he became an enthusiast. As he read and heard about various authors and predecessors, he sometimes became harshly condemning. Sometimes these enthusiasms and condemnations were very fleeting, but other times they had a more profound impact on Nietzsche's philosophy and tended to last for quite some time. So what we'd like to do this lecture is to run through some of Nietzsche's favorites and some of Nietzsche's favorite targets, and we'd like to provide two top 10 lists of Nietzsche's favorites and targets. First, here are Nietzsche's favorite philosophers and thinkers.
Number 10 on Nietzsche's favorite list is Richard Wagner. Nietzsche was impressed by Wagner for a number of reasons, one of which being the ambition with which he synthesized various kinds of art forms in his music dramas. Nietzsche also appreciated the kinds of themes he worked with, especially the idea of taking a particular goal or mission and serving it with true devotion, which becomes thematic in some of Wagner's plays. Also, he thought that Wagner had it right when he presented some of the attitudes or emotions musically. He thought that Wagner was probably the great artist of the miniature emotion and the musical manner of conveying these emotions. So even though he eventually turned against Wagner, Wagner remained in these respects his favorite.
Number 9 would be Arthur Schopenhauer, who was, of course, also Wagner's favorite philosopher, but certainly became the dominant influence in Nietzsche's early philosophy. Nietzsche admired, for example, his notion of will, which remains with him throughout his philosophy, particularly in the notion of the will to power. He admired Schopenhauer's independence and also, one has to say, his cantankerousness. In his early essay on Schopenhauer, he says that Schopenhauer was the first honest German atheist, and it's clear that this was a model that Nietzsche would follow throughout his career as well.
Number 8 on Nietzsche's favorite list, Immanuel Kant. Again, Kant is someone he has mixed feelings about, but he certainly admired what he viewed as Kant's courage. He even describes him in Birth of Tragedy as a kind of tragic knight. I think what he has in mind is that Kant, despite his desire to systematize everything, recognized the limits of reason to know, and he considered that an amazing show of courage on the part of someone temperamentally not so inclined. I think he also greatly admired Kant's influence. You couldn't be a German in the 19th century and not have to cope with Kant's critiques.
Number 7 on the favorites list would be Spinoza. Now, Spinoza might seem like a very distant figure to Nietzsche, and occasionally Nietzsche does have harsh things to say about him. But in 1881, when he first read Spinoza, he wrote this letter to one of his friends, Franz Overbeck. "I'm utterly amazed, utterly enchanted. I have a precursor, and what a precursor. I hardly knew Spinoza. That I should have turned to him just now was inspired by instinct. Not only is his overall tendency like mine, namely to make knowledge the most powerful affect, but in 5 main points of his doctrine I recognize myself. This most unusual and loneliest thinker is closest to me precisely in these matters. He denies the freedom of the will, teleology, the moral world order, the unegoistic, and evil. Even though the divergencies are admittedly tremendous, they are due more to the difference in time, culture, and in science. In summary, my loneliness is now at least a twosomeness."
Number 6 on Nietzsche's favorite list, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson is the only American that makes either of these lists, for that matter, but Nietzsche seemed to have particular enthusiasm for Emerson, so much so that some of his central ideas have names that perhaps come originally from Emerson. Walter Kaufmann suggests, for instance, that Nietzsche may have gotten the idea for the Übermensch, or Overman, from Emerson's Oversoul. Emerson talks about a joyous science, and one might hear resonances of that in Nietzsche's title, The Gay Science. Emerson's essay, Self-Reliance, certainly picks up on many themes Nietzsche wants to defend, and even the idea of the death of God has its precedence in Emerson. In Emerson's Divinity School address, for instance, he claimed, "Men have come to speak of the revelation as something long ago given and done, as if God were dead." And he goes on to express his own reasons for parting with Orthodox religion, for religious motives, something that Nietzsche would also appreciate. Emerson continues, "We have contrasted the church with the soul. In the soul, then, let the redemption be sought. The stationariness of religion, the assumption that the age of inspiration is past, that the Bible is closed, the fear of degrading the character of Jesus by representing him as a man, indicate with sufficient clearness the falsehood of our theology."
Number 5 on the favorites list would be Sophocles, the Greek playwright. One might add to this Aeschylus, his close compatriot, also Homer, their illustrious predecessor. And one might, I suppose, argue Heraclitus belongs to this group too, all of them pre-Socratic Greeks. Of Sophocles, Nietzsche has a great deal to say, particularly in The Birth of Tragedy. In a way, Sophocles invented, or at any rate, perfected tragedy. Nietzsche writes of him, "Sophocles understood the most sorrowful figure of the Greek stage, the unfortunate Oedipus, as the noble human being. The noble human being does not sin. The profound poet wants to tell us, though every law, every natural order, even the moral world way may perish through his actions also produce a higher magical circle of effects which found a new world on the ruins of the old one that has now been overthrown. That is what the poet wants to say to us insofar as he is at the same time a religious thinker."
Number 4 on Nietzsche's favorite list, Goethe. Nietzsche admires Goethe as a luminary of German culture, and indeed, arguably, someone that he wants to, in a sense, challenge for the title of luminary. He comments, for instance, "When I speak of Plato, Pascal, Spinoza, and Goethe, then I know that their blood rolls in mine." And he also describes himself as one of the few leading lights of German literary prowess, including Goethe also on that list. He seems to appreciate Goethe especially for being so affirmative, for being a yes-saying kind of person. He even describes Goethe as a paradigm of the Dionysian man, something that a person with more classical style of behavior and demeanor as Goethe might have found surprising. Particularly, he admires the way in which Goethe had a kind of conscious notion of setting the stage for Europe's future. Nietzsche comments, "Goethe, not a German event, but a European one. A magnificent attempt to overcome the 18th century by a return to nature, by an ascent to the naturalness of the Renaissance. He bore its strongest instincts within himself. He disciplined himself. He created himself." And Nietzsche concludes, "Goethe is the last German for whom I feel any reverence."
Number 3 on the favorites list would be Zarathustra, or Zoroaster, the Persian prophet. The historical Zarathustra lived from the 7th to 6th centuries before Jesus. It is now quite clear, as Kathy said in a previous lecture, that Nietzsche knew quite a bit about him. It's not just a name. Zarathustra sort of prefigures Jesus in a number of ways. For example, he is often credited as being one of the inventors of monotheism, or at any rate, he picked one god of all the others to worship. He also created something that would seem to be anathema to Nietzsche, and that is he defined the distinction between good and evil. And Nietzsche says that, as Kathy quoted, that part of the reason for choosing Zarathustra as the spokesperson in one of Nietzsche's most famous books is precisely because, having created that distinction, he should be the one to overcome it. But he also admires Zarathustra as an honest and courageous thinker, someone who stood up against the prior establishment traditions, intellectual thought of the time, and actually invented a new religion, something that Nietzsche clearly admires. He also admires his insight, his emphasis on the this-worldly, something which is quite clearly present even in Zarathustra's most religious moments, and also the fact that he was a revolutionary. Zarathustra overcame at the same time that he invented what we call morality, and there's a sense in which what is emphasized in his religion is the kind of self-overcoming that Nietzsche is always emphasizing, a transformation of self, making oneself better. And for that, Zarathustra deserves a place on the list.
Number 2 on Nietzsche's favorites list, Jesus. This may seem somewhat surprising given what he has to say about Christianity, but Nietzsche distinguishes Christianity decisively from the views and practices of Jesus. Jesus, he claims, was the only Christian. And he seems to admire Jesus tremendously. Even the fact that he parodies the New Testament to a certain extent testifies to that. Particularly, he seems to see Jesus as someone who viewed the kingdom of God as being here among us and living according to that philosophy. The fact that Jesus is another revolutionary who is willing to live his philosophy strikes Nietzsche as definitely worth praise.
Number one on Nietzsche's top favorite list is, I feel we should have a drum roll, Socrates. Now, on the one hand, we've made a great deal out of the idea that Socrates is often a target of Nietzsche's criticism, but the truth is that there's no philosophy in the history of the subject that's been closer to Nietzsche's heart. He writes at one point, "Socrates, to confess it frankly, is so close to me that almost always I fight a fight against him." And indeed, it is a lover's quarrel that the fight with Socrates is a fight of equals, or at least from Nietzsche's point of view, a fight of equals. Socrates is someone that Nietzsche very much envies. He wants to be just like him. Like Hegel before him, Nietzsche compares Socrates to Jesus. And he remarks at one point that it's sort of remarkable that Socrates and Plato, too, were so brilliant and so original and revolutionary, but yet neither one succeeded in founding a religion, as, of course, Jesus did. Nevertheless, there's no question but that Nietzsche sees Socrates as his model for his courage, his integrity, for his sense of standing up for what he believed, for his brilliance in argument, for his charm. And in general, one has to say that ultimately what Nietzsche wanted was to really be just like him.
What struck us when we were compiling this list is how many individuals showed up actually on both. And with that in mind, let's start Nietzsche's target list.
First on Nietzsche's target list, number 10, would be Wagner. Nietzsche broke with him back in 1876, in part for his anti-Semitism, which he found repulsive. But he also found him arrogant. He found him irresponsible. He accused him of being a decadent. Whereas Nietzsche had earlier greatly admired Wagner's music, for example, operas such as Tristan, he comes to think of Wagner's music as sick and as sickly. Parsifal, in particular, he found a complete sellout. He found it a kind of mawkish, one might say even a kind of kitsch Christianity, instead of the heroic myths that Wagner had tried to create in his earlier operas. He also found Wagner increasingly nationalistic, chauvinistic, representing and celebrating the New Germany, which Nietzsche, of course, despised. Whereas previously he considered Wagner's productions grand, even kind of grandeur, he now found them simply grandstanding, and he greatly criticized the Bayreuth festivals in particular as being overly showy, appealing to the wrong kind of people. They were mere festivals in which people would flash their wealth rather than, in any sense, entertain thoughts of serious music or philosophical thoughts. In Nietzsche contra Wagner, one of Nietzsche's last works, he writes, "By the summer of 1876, during the time of my first Festspiele, I said farewell to Wagner in my heart. Since Wagner had moved to Germany, he had condescended step by step to everything I despise, even to anti-Semitism." And he writes, "I had had nobody except Wagner." And Nietzsche says that he was sick, weary from the disappointment, the wasted energy, work, hope, youth, love, weary from nausea at the whole idealistic lie.
Number 9 on Nietzsche's target list, Schopenhauer. Nietzsche had come to reject a number of things in Schopenhauer's philosophy later in life. In general, he rejected the extremity of Schopenhauer's pessimism and Schopenhauer's medicine for it, renunciation. Nietzsche thought that this was a way of withdrawing from life, not of engaging with life, and that was something he no longer thought very highly of as a method. He also rejected Schopenhauer's emphasis on what he calls mysticism, the sense that we're all one. Although Nietzsche himself writes occasionally in the same sort of language, Nietzsche always maintains a kind of respect for individuality that he thinks Schopenhauer didn't really engage in. And finally, Schopenhauer's ethical system, particularly the emphasis on pity or compassion, Nietzsche had reasons to object to. He thought that Schopenhauer had really gone the wrong direction here, and that if Schopenhauer had remained truer to himself in his atheism and some of the other features of his philosophy, things would have been much better.
Number 8 on the target list, is Immanuel Kant. To be sure, Nietzsche, like every German thinker, had great respect and admiration for Kant. Nevertheless, Kant often enters in as a favorite target, a nemesis, of Nietzsche's own thinking, with particular reference to two points. First of all, and most importantly, morality. Kant had defended precisely that concept of morality which Nietzsche wanted to overthrow or undermine. Kant thought of morality as something that was purely rational, something that consisted of universal principles dictated by reason, something that applied equally to every human being without exception. And of course, Nietzsche's notion of morality is just the opposite, that basically it is something very individual. It is not particularly rational. It comes about largely, he says, even by various mistakes, trial and error. It's a product of evolution. And there, what we should be looking at is not what applies to everyone, but rather what furthers the most exceptional individuals. Second point, of course, is that Kant, in his epistemology and metaphysics, in his theory of knowledge and theory of reality, goes on to talk about the thing in itself. Now, this, of course, is a notion that had gone all the way back in philosophy, at least as far back as Parmenides. Nevertheless, Kant gives it a special modern twist, something that, of course, comes out in Schopenhauer, against whom Nietzsche is directly reacting. As a super-rationalist, Kant is in many ways antithetical to Nietzsche's whole emphasis on the passions and the importance of the passions. Reason here is taken not just as the ability to calculate, figure, and so on, but reason is taken as some sort of privileged window to the truth, a way we have of making contact with the world as it really is, not to mention with God and morality as well. He says, the instinct which errs without fail, anti-nature as instinct, German decadence as philosophy, that is Kant. The whole idea that what Kant proposes is not something naturalistic, not something that we find inherent in ourselves, but rather something which is dictated to us, even if by reason, is something that Nietzsche finds insufferable. And the notion of decadence, of course, is Nietzsche's all-purpose insult for anyone who is on or part of a cultural decline, which he certainly sees Kant. He says in Twilight of the Idols, "The true world, an idea which is no longer good for anything, not even obligating," a direct reference to Kant, "an idea which has become useless and superfluous, consequently a refuted idea. Let us abolish it." And he says, with reference to Kant, "The old Kant had obtained the thing in itself by stealth, and was punished for this when the categorical imperative crept stealthily into his heart and led him astray, back to God, soul, freedom, and immortality, like a fox who loses his way and goes astray back into the cage. Yet it had been his strength and cleverness that had broken open the cage." As always, harsh criticism mixed with a grudging admiration. In fact, he even goes so far as to say that despite Kant's notoriously difficult style, Kant may have had a kind of irony in mind which is not available to most readers. He calls it Kant's joke. Kant wanted to prove in a way that would dumbfound the common man that the common man, in fact, was right.
Number 7 on Nietzsche's target list, Descartes. Descartes is probably not often seen as someone that Nietzsche talks a great deal about because Nietzsche doesn't emphasize the same epistemological questions that Descartes does, but actually he manages to infiltrate quite a few criticisms throughout his writings. One of the things he objected to was Descartes' general dissociation of mind and body. Descartes used this as a way of not only defending the continued existence of the soul after death, but also as a way of defending his rationalism, his insistence that we know things through the mind and its interconnections, not by means of the senses. To take issue with this, Nietzsche remarks, "What magnificent instruments of human observation we possess in the senses. The nose, for example, is actually the most delicate instrument so far at our disposal." He also objects to Descartes' use of the supernatural in what appears to be a quasi-scientific argument. He comments, for instance, "Descartes could prove the reality of the empirical world only by appealing to the truthfulness of God and his inability to alter falsehood." A further matter that Nietzsche differs from Descartes on is the question of consciousness. Descartes, in his famous Cogito, "I think, therefore I am," ends up concluding his own existence by virtue of recognizing the existence of consciousness. Nietzsche questions this because he thinks that the unconscious is actually probably a greater part of ourselves than our conscious mind is. And finally, Descartes' general rejection of the body as anything very important. Nietzsche comments, "And above all, away with the body, this wretched idée fixe of the senses, disfigured by all the fallacies of logic, refuted, even impossible, although it is impudent enough to behave as if it were real." Nietzsche, of course, thinks it is real, and Descartes was the person who was impudent.
Number six on the target list is the English philosopher John Stuart Mill. Now, Nietzsche's relationship to the English is always a bit odd, very mixed. On the one hand, like most of the enlightened Germans of his time, he looked to England for the source of many new ideas, many innovations, and many of these he highly approved of. Mill in particular would seem to be very much a kindred spirit with Nietzsche. For one thing, Mill also was a philosopher who also considered himself a psychologist. Second, Mill was a strict empiricist, in fact, in some ways a more radical empiricist than his predecessors Locke and Hume. And you would think that Nietzsche, with his very naturalistic empiricist bias, would think that this was a great thing. But Mill was known in Germany primarily as the spokesman for the philosophy called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism was the view, first of all, that people basically aim for pleasure or the avoidance of pain, and also that everyone should be counted equally, and the greatest good for the greatest number is the target to aim at. For Nietzsche, the pleasure hypothesis was something he utterly wanted to repudiate and replace with his own will to power hypothesis. It's with Mill in mind that he says his famous crack, "Man does not live for pleasure, only the Englishman does." And also, of course, Nietzsche despised the equality hypothesis. The idea that everyone does or should count for equal is something that rubbed against him every bit of the way. He thought that people should be treated as individuals, and to treat them as individuals is to treat them on the basis of their merits, their individual talents, their potentials, and that, just as a matter of fact, shows that people are not equals, should not be thought of as equals, and utilitarianism was therefore an insidious leveling position. In general, he found the whole notion of utilitarianism vulgar, as did most Germans. And so, while it's probably highly unfair to John Stuart Mill himself, who was a very sophisticated, artful philosopher, who I think actually was much more of an Aristotelian than Nietzsche recognizes, as was Nietzsche himself, the upshot is that Nietzsche would put him up on the target list and doesn't even mention him as one of the favorites.
Number five on Nietzsche's target list, Euripides. Nietzsche considered Euripides to be responsible for the death of Greek tragedy, despite the fact that Euripides is one of the most famous of Greek tragedians. Nietzsche thought that Euripides killed tragedy by becoming too much under the sway of Socrates. He claims that Euripides' plays reveal a kind of aesthetic Socratism, that to be beautiful means to be intelligible, and that Euripides therefore made many different kinds of changes in the standard way that tragedies were constructed in order to make audiences clear about what was happening. Most importantly, Euripides removed the important presence of the chorus from all but sort of a vestigial role, and the result was that the audience was no longer captivated by the music and drawn into this religious state. Instead, they dealt with the tragic plot entirely by means of understanding, and thus lost the kind of answer to the problem of evil that tragedy was designed to provide.
Number four on the target list is Martin Luther. Now, it's obvious that Luther and his reformed Christianity is a target for Nietzsche. It's what he grew up with. His father was, after all, a Lutheran minister. But what's often not recognized, and what we've tried to emphasize in these lectures, is that there's more of a continuation that people would usually let on than Nietzsche himself was often willing to admit, that, in fact, much of Nietzsche's thought shows clear Lutheran underpinnings, and he admired Luther as a kind of hero. For one thing, it was Luther who had the guts to stand up and say to the entire Catholic Church, "This isn't right, and we've got to do it a different way." He came up with his own ideas. Luther probably would have rejected much of what came to follow him. And Nietzsche, of course, rejects not so much Luther as Lutheranism. Nevertheless, there's a depravity in Luther that Nietzsche sees very clearly. It comes out in his ideas, many of the ideas about grace and salvation and so on, but it also comes out in, as always, Luther's own personality. And Nietzsche abounds in ad hominem arguments against him. He says, for example, Luther was a man of the common people who lacked everything that one might inherit from a ruling caste. He had no instinct for power. Thus his work, without his knowing or willing it, became nothing but the beginning of a work of destruction. He smashed an ideal that he could not attain, while he seemed to abhor and be fighting only against the degeneration of the ideal. And elsewhere in Gay Science he writes, what afterward grew out of his reformation, good as well as bad, might be calculated approximately today. But who would be naive enough to praise or blame Luther on account of these consequences? He is innocent of everything. He didn't know what he was doing.
Number 3 on Nietzsche's target list, St. Paul. St. Paul he views as, in a sense, the opportunist of Christianity, Christianity's primary propagandist, and someone who took the movement that Christ began, or that Jesus began, and turned it in his own directions for his own personal gain. Nietzsche describes him as a mind as superstitious as it was cunning. And in particular, he objects to the way that St. Paul rationalized the story of Christ's life and death in order to make it part of an atonement story, a matter in which God is appeased by means of a completely barbaric death inflicted upon his own son. Nietzsche objects to St. Paul through and through and suggests that some of the notions that Paul encourages in terms of morality are really themselves quite decadent. For example, he comments, people like St. Paul have an evil eye for the passions. All they know is what is dirty, disfiguring, and heartbreaking. Hence, their idealistic tendency aims at the annihilation of the passions, and they find perfect purity in the divine. St. Paul, he also thought, was quite impudent in promoting the notion of personal immortality, and he also considered his logicizing a kind of impudence against the life of Christ. In fact, he concludes, at bottom, Paul had no use at all for the life of the Redeemer. He needed the death on the cross and a little more.
Number 2 on the target list, we put Plato. Now, as we said before, Plato and Socrates are not always easily distinguished. Plato most certainly put a lot of words in Socrates' mouth. And at the same time, Socrates gave Plato a lot of his ideas. He was, after all, his teacher. But Plato, unlike Socrates, has a fully developed philosophy. And it's a philosophy that Nietzsche finds great fault with. He sees Plato as the precursor of Christianity. He sees Plato as the primary instigator of the otherworldly vision. The whole idea of a world of being, a more perfect world, an eternal world other than this one, is something that Nietzsche, of course, is fighting against his entire career. It's what Zarathustra comes down out of the mountain to preach against. At the same time, of course, there's a kind of grudging admiration for Plato, but still, he shares with Socrates the emphasis on the hyper-rational, the idea that reason will, in a sense, show us the truth. It is a kind of war on the instincts and very much an attempt to lift us above our natural selves. He gave up writing plays for the dialogues, and one might think that Nietzsche would admire, more than anything else, Plato's literary style, something which philosophers and scholars today, of course, think a great deal of. But Nietzsche doesn't just attack the philosophy, he attacks the literary form in which Plato presents it and says, in effect, the nastiest crack, that he should have stuck with writing plays and his attempt to mix philosophy with philosophy and playwriting just didn't work at all.
Finally, the last of the targets, Socrates. Nietzsche thought Socrates was absurdly rational, as we've pointed out. He considered this motivation for absurd rationality to ultimately be a kind of disagreement with life, a sense that life was worthless, something Nietzsche thought has only led to decadence in the tradition that he founded. And ultimately, he thought Socrates was really rather imbalanced. He was someone that was so logical, he forgot other things that were important to life, and thus the philosophy that came in his wake is imbalanced as well.
As always with Nietzsche, one can't take these lists too seriously, but we have tried to show that he was a man of very strong opinions, and often towards the same people. There are many figures that might have been added, for example, Darwin on both lists, but the real upshot of the lecture is that if you hear Nietzsche quoted about some figure, even very harshly or very high of praise, out of context, always take it with a grain of salt, because the truth is that Nietzsche was a man of love-hate relationships, and nothing is ever all that simple.